From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. With a chill creeping into the air, it's that time of year. You want to curl up on the couch with a blanket and a book. This hour, the book doctors return to help you choose a few titles. Want to add some goosebumps to match the chill as you get ready for Halloween? They're bringing their favorite mysteries with a touch of horror to highlight the ghoulish holiday. So hunker down with a great story, get comfortable in your favorite chair, but keep a few lights on, if you dare. It could get spooky as we get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, the book doctors are in the house just in time for cooler weather and thoughts of All Hallows Eve, which is a public radio way of saying something far simpler, Halloween. No matter, the good doctors have brought us some good reads appropriate for the season, and who knows what they've come up with here. The book doctors today are Jeffrey Ann Gotti. She's a freelance writer, editor, and reviewer. Jeff, always good to have you.
Thank you. Welcome back. Thank you for having me, Steve.
Steve Paul edits the Star's book page. Steve, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing pretty well.
Katie Stover is Director of Reader Services for the Kansas City Public Library. Katie, nice to have you. Good morning.
Always a pleasure.
And Mark Luce is back. He's Chair of the English Department and Senior Dean at the Barstow School. Mark, good morning to you.
Good morning. I'm not the Senior Dean anymore.
You're not the Senior Dean.
No, I'm Director of Humanities.
Director of Humanities. Okay. Yeah. We got
Check
it straight
that out.
Here. Yeah, we got it. We're going to talk about good Halloween stories today, scary stories and scary, lots more scary stories. So are good scary stories still being written, Steve Paul, or for a truly frightening read, do you have to go back to the classics to sort of get some of that?
Stephen King is always with us. He's got a brand new book, which I haven't read. I don't know if anybody else has. There might be somebody out there in the audience. Shirley has been reading the new Stephen King book, but beyond that, yeah, horror is still a major genre. Mysteries with really dark underbelly settings, and people the noir genre. I mean, it's all over the place, and it seems like dark mysteries have become one of the strongest genres in the book world. So people still love to be scared. I don't get it. It's never been one of my favorite things.
Your things.
So you put me on the spot on something that I have nothing to say.
Can I interject?
Yes, Jeff.
Steve, Paul, did you not edit Kansas City Noir?
Oh, well, that's a self-serving thing that we shouldn't be talking about.
Yeah. That's not
yes,
horror.
I did.
That's,
yes, I did.
Not exactly
it's
horror.
It's dark.
Yeah.
It was dark.
Very dark. Many of the stories in there were very dark and very creepy, and it worked very well.
Katie Stover, how does Stephen King, how will he be remembered someday in terms of what he's brought to the world in terms of fright and horror and all those kinds of things? Is he a true master of the art, or is he something else?
Oh, he's a master of the art. I expect, actually, Stephen King to be remembered for The Stand. That's his literary work. All of his horror books, though, have been appealing to readers since he came on the scene, especially with Carrie. Teens are still reading Carrie. That's a wonderful outsider teen book to just sink your fangs into. But Stephen King's horror, he finds the scary in everyday objects, in cell phones, in clowns, in the family
trucks.
Pet, in
trucks, yeah.
Trucks.
Yeah,
yeah.
And crazy people.
Crazy people, sure. Who isn't scared of crazy people? But now I'm scared of my Bel Air, I'm scared of my cat, and I'm scared to answer my cell phone. So other authors are picking up on that and looking for the creepy in everyday household items. I brought one of those books with me.
I was a real latecomer to Stephen King, and sometime in the 80s, I think it was, I read Misery when it came out, and I got to say I was rather impressed by it, and I was taken by this style, but it was a much shorter book than the big, 1,000-page King opuses that I'm not sure.
Yeah, I would think I would tend to think that I would tend to think that in 100 years King will still be around.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he'll be talked of in the same way that Poe is, but I honestly wouldn't be that surprised. His output is basically as prolific. Over the last decade or so, he's reached out and done a couple different things. He had a style guide kind of deal. He did some nonfiction work.
He wrote a book about writing that people admired. He's a god.
Yeah,
well, generally speaking, do you have to go back to the classics to find the great stuff, Mark, or is there contemporary stuff being put out that sort of does the same thing, even better?
Well, see, I'm not a fan of horror with vampires and werewolves and these kind of things. I'm more of a fan of suspense.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the detective stories and this kind of thing. I mean, I think even something like the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series has plenty of suspense and thrill.
And horror. I mean, real violence. The horror
and
the violence.
To me, I don't go for the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more of
I don't either.
The serial killers, psychopaths, sociopaths, this kind of thing. You can certainly still find those today, and you can find them if you go back. Poe's great, but there's a great collection called The Dead Witness. It's edited by a fellow named Michael Sims, and so it goes back to Victorian detective stories,
mm-hmm.
which really aren't detective stories like we would think of. They tend to be a little creepier than that, and so like Wilkie Collins. There's this great the story The Dead Witness by a woman named Mary Fortune, which is set in Australia, is one of the creepier stories that I think I've read in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
James McGovern, Emile Gaboriau, these guys that are basically precursors to Doyle, there's a sense of the Gothic in here, even though they're Victorians. So that kind of stuff, I think, is a lot of fun without, the
gore. Well, Sherlock Holmes.
Gore
the Sherlock Holmes stories certainly qualify.
Oh, yeah.
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 Horror
is
whatever scares you. Sometimes I read a lot of horror just to stay on top of what people are reading in the vampire, werewolf, zombie world. But I was talking to Jeff earlier. When I think about the books that scare me, the ones that I find horrifying, The Road by Cormac McCarthy,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and
oh,
Age
yeah.
of Miracles
Age
by
of
Karen
Miracles.
Thompson Walker, and Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris. Those scare me more than some of the horror that I brought with me, because to me those things are real. I don't believe in zombies and witches and werewolves,
vampires.
So I'm not worried about that. I don't mind watching that on film either. But when I watched The Road and when I read The Road, that scared the life out of me, because the apocalypse could happen.
I can remember as a kid reading this series of books called The Three Investigators. I don't know if that rings a bell.
Oh,
it's
yes.
sort of like The Hardy Boys. but the first book of that was The Secret of Terror Castle, I think, was the title of the book. And at age 12 or whatever it was when I read that book, I remember being so scared. I was just absolutely stiff, just couldn't move. And I went back and read that book to my kids not long ago, and I was trying to think, what was it about this?
That actually
so
scared
much,
me.
Yeah, that seems so tame now, but it was absolutely riveting. It was so, so terrifying when I read it as a boy. And what a thrill in a weird way that is, to be that absorbed in something that takes you somewhere completely different.
Well, nowadays we have the wonderful Lemony Snicket, for example,
series,
which, both in print and the occasional movie, I think.
The Baudelaire twins.
Extraordinarily
well written.
Yeah.
Very arch, but also creepy and scary.
Yeah,
thanks for reminding
exactly.
me of those. I read all of those to Alex.
Yeah.
Steve, you're talking about when I was in, I think it was like 3-4 days ago, I was walking through the lower school library and I saw a copy. It had the skull on it, and it was called Some Things Fierce and Fatal. And it just it struck me for a second, and I realized that this is a book that I checked out in fifth grade.
There you go.
And it was the same sort of thing where
yeah.
it was a collection of stories. And the first one, I actually had to go look it up because I couldn't tell you what the stories were. But I remembered that the first one terrified me to the point of where I almost didn't want to read the rest of the book. But of course, you're 10, 11, 12.
Yeah.
Of course you do.
Mm-hmm.
But it was by a guy named C.S. Forster.
Oh, sure.
And
oh,
it was called The Turn of the Tide. And I honestly, I haven't read it for however many years that is, a lot. But that same sort of like, and the Hardy Boys, Clue of the Shattered Helmet.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
You know, yeah. I didn't read the Hardy Boys, but I did read Nancy Drew Mysteries, but they weren't very scary.
No, those aren't scary.
They were so inspiring for the young girl.
Yeah. Well, if our listeners want to chime in with some reads they found absolutely mortifyingly terrifying, give us a call, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Okay, Katie Stover, let's go to some books that you brought in today, and many of them scary. This one is, This Book is Full of Spiders by David Wong.
Yes. Your garden pests are out to get you. And that's going to be the theme of all the horror books I brought. Something is out to get you, Steve. Yeah. this one is the sequel to cult fave John Dies at the End. And I believe that's a film that's coming out sometime soon. It's a small town, but something's got to haunt it. And John and Dave just aren't sure what. They're our heroes. And it looks like the apocalypse is coming. And you know what? It's all your fault, all you Walking Dead and Zombieland fans. Because John and Dave learn that all the books and movies about zombies, they might have brought about the zombie apocalypse that everyone is really afraid of and eagerly preparing for. Now, it sounds kind of outlandish and fun, and it is. This book is full of goofy horror fun. But really, think about it. If enough people believed in something, could they turn it into a reality? Could people believing that the zombie apocalypse is on the horizon really bring about a zombie apocalypse? Or is it just really the spiders living in your brain, telling you what to do, what to see, what to think? So our two slacker heroes, John and Dave, with the help of Molly, the original Hoover dog, they're your only salvation. So, you know, yeah, we're in big trouble. Big, fun, scary trouble. And no spiders or zombies were injured while writing this review. So it's this book is full of spiders. Yeah, seriously.
And
it's full
of
spiders.
For people of what age?
Oh, this could appeal to teen readers. I would give this to 17 or 18 year old boy. Give it to girls who like to read fun comic horror. Really good for fans of Christopher Moore or Tom Holt.
All right. Sounds good. Jeff, take us to Cartwheel by Jennifer DuBois.
Yeah, I'm really not a big fan of thrillers and chillers, but I would echo what Katie said, though. If you want to stretch the genre and encompass apocalyptic literature, that rings my bell for sure. But to talk about Cartwheel by Jennifer DuBois, I actually requested this book. I was considering reviewing it for The Star. And I loved her first book, A Partial History of Lost Causes, which was full of Russian history and politics and chess. But I really felt like Cartwheel fell flat. But it has a murder at its core, so I brought it in. At the start of this book is a little message from the author that says this story is loosely based on the Amanda Knox case.
Wow.
Because I had sort of an unhealthy fascination with the Amanda Knox story, I say this is very tightly tied to the Amanda Knox case. Amanda Knox, you remember, was convicted in 2009 of stabbing her British roommate. Then her conviction was overturned, and the Italian court has taken it up again. She's being tried in absentia. And this book is not set in Italy. It's set in Argentina, and it is about a character named Lily Hayes who has murdered her roommate. You'll remember that Amanda Knox was widely criticized because she allegedly did a cartwheel in police custody. That turned out to be false. In this book, Lily Hayes actually does a cartwheel in police custody. Amanda Knox was criticized for being cavalier, cold, flippant after the murder. In this book, Lily Hayes is cold, calculated, flippant after the murder. And I think actually what DuBois was trying to do, I'm trying to fathom what her purpose was, is to write a prismatic book that reflects all points of view equally. But what happens then is there's no emotional core, and the characters are pretty flat. So I'm hoping that this is sort of the sophomore slump and that her third book will be better.
Okay.
But it did have a murder in it, so I brought it in.
Yeah,
because
okay.
Otherwise I'm here on borrowed papers.
Cartwheel by Jennifer DuBois there by Jeff Ann Gowdy.
And this was just published, I think, September 24th, so it's a very
brand new
book. And it's getting sort of mixed reviews.
Okay. We're visiting with our book doctors this morning about good fall Halloween scary reads. Let's go to some calls here. Denise from Overland Park. Denise, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, I just wanted to mention Dean Koontz as a writer that I think can send chills right down your spine over what I think what you guys are talking about with Stephen King, and not necessarily something ordinary, but more situations that are more ordinary and can make them extremely scary, and usually he throws in a moral dilemma for these people as well, so they have a moral dilemma they have to kind of get over. So it's always interesting to see how they'll try to resolve that, but at the same time scare the pants off of you while you're reading the book.
Huh. My good neighbor, my good friend Kent Peterson's a big Dean Koontz fan. Lots of Dean Koontz fans out there, I think.
I think, well, he's a prolific writer, so he's got tons of books. So you can always choose. And other than, I'm a fan of the Odd Thomas series, which you kind of need to start at the beginning to kind of understand that. But there are a lot of books. Most of his books are standalone, so you could pick up most any of his books and just get right into it.
There you go. Denise, I'm glad you called. Thanks.
Thank you.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here for your recommendations for good, scary reads. Our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org, or you can tweet us at kcurUpToDate. Mark.
Okay, well, I've got a pair of serial killer books.
All right.
So the first one is called The Lodger. It's by Marie Belloc Lowndes. It was written in 1914, I think. It could have been 1915. And it's basically the story of Jack the Ripper. And so, and what Lowndes has done is she's taken a couple, has fallen kind of on hard times, Robert Bunting and his wife, Ellen. And they're fairly simple people. And so but they're out of money. And they bought a house that they probably couldn't afford, and they need to take in a lodger. And so a young man shows up named Mr. Sleuth, not the best name in the world, but and Mr. Sleuth takes the room. And Ellen develops this sort of fascination, almost like a mothering quality towards this fellow who, as the book goes on, we're more and more sure that he is this. We actually know from the start that he's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we watch this kind of play out. It's definitely suspenseful. It's a lot of fun. Mr. Sleuth is particularly devious and charming. So it's really a pleasant, insofar as you can have a pleasant look at the Whitechapel murders, this is a pretty good one. It's very funny. The other one is The Devil in the White City, which I actually have never read. I had been told about it for years and years and years, and everybody that's ever read it, I think, loves it. And so I just picked it up the other day.
And who wrote that again?
Eric Larson.
Yeah, right. Who's got so many good books.
Yeah,
out.
He's he wrote the one about the Nazis.
The Nazis,
In the Garden of the Beast.
In the Garden of the Beast, Oh, that was a...
So this one is about two different people. It's about the architect, Daniel Burnham. Burnham. Who did the Giant White City for the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago. But then it's also about this dude, H.H. Holmes, who is sort of like regarded as the first serial killer. And he is a creepy, creepy fellow. He basically took over this pharmacy, turned it into a hotel, and then would have all these like mazes and secret rooms and stuff. And he would throw people in the incinerator, and he'd sell cadavers and insurance scams. And so, I mean, if that's your thing, this is where to go.
Yeah. A couple of you guys have mentioned the Sherlock Holmes books already this hour. Do those books still hold up? If you want to read a great detective story, are they still good?
It's been a long time. Yeah. I don't see any reason why they wouldn't. Lately, they've been transformed into a British and an American TV series. They're certainly still inspire.
I came to Doyle very late, a couple years ago, and they're just fun to read. I mean, I don't think he's the most spectacular writer in the world by any stretch of the imagination, but the cases are fun.
Yeah.
And some are better than others, mm-hmm. certainly. I found The Hounds of Baskervilles to be a little Come on, can we get to it?
Yeah.
Can we get to it already?
Yeah. I like that story.
All that trudging over the moors.
There's a lot of trudging. There's a lot of trudging, like hiding in the weeds. Where are you? He's in the weeds somewhere.
Yeah.
He's in the hovel.
That story worked for me. That story worked for me from the get-go. I just loved it. Yeah, my son read it and had me read it. You know?
Those shows, well, especially the British one, they've updated it so nicely. That you really, it comes through. And I don't know about the American one. Everybody says that it's good, but I haven't really seen it.
I really haven't seen it.
This is on PBS?
Mm-hmm. The first Sherlock, and they're getting ready to start the third season with Benedict Cumberbatch.
Cumberbatch.
All right. Well, Katie, let's come back to you here. Ghost Radio by Leopoldo Gout.
Oh, yes. Your appliances are out to get you. This is one of those under-the-radar horror novels. I mean, when it came out, pulling up the year, it's 2008, I loved it and was giving it to all the teen 20-something horror fans I know. I thought it was fantastic. It was the first novel from Leopoldo Gout, and it gets you thinking about the airwaves and disc jockeys with a little trepidation because it focuses on Joaquin. He's a former punk rocker, and he hosts a radio show called Ghost Radio, and it's a call-in show on Mexican airwaves. And he survived a deadly car crash that killed his parents and the parents of his best friend, Gabriel. And so this radio show just has callers all over the world sharing their own ghostly encounters, their own ghost stories. And all he does is listen. He's not trying to solve the puzzle for the call-in folk. He's just listening. And some of the stories that the listeners share are really creepy. They're far creepier than the bigger story that surrounds Ghost Radio. Joaquin is offered a slot on an American radio show, which actually puts him back in a town where something horrible that involving his best friend happened. So he's got to go back and confront his own ghosts now. And he's bringing his girlfriend with him, and she's toting some of her own demons. So it just turns into this vengeful, ghostly, paranormal clash on the airwaves. It's a really deft blend of radio science, the paranormal, and call-in show culture. This is really good.
Let me tell you about that sometime. all the mysteries that surround this studio.
Yeah. Oh, I'm giving this one to Michael Byers on my way out. Yeah. This is Ghost Radio by Leopoldo Gout.
And it's for anyone?
This one I would give to teens. This one I was reading for an award I was on, Adult Books for Teens, and I really thought it had a lot of potential. No one else on the committee thought so.
Okay.
But it was hard. Horror was a hard sell, and I was the one doing the selling.
Well, Kate emails us this at uptodate@kcur.org. Raoul Dahl's Book of Ghost Stories. I wasn't aware that he had put out a book of ghost stories. Anyone familiar with it?
I'm sure. I mean, I have no doubt that they're good. I mean, we know him. Everything is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and the kids stuff. But his adult stuff is hysterical. There's this story called Sacrificial Lamb about a woman who comes home and her husband decides he's going to leave her, and she beats him senseless with the lamb she was making for him.
With the lamb?
Yeah.
That sounds like a scene from an Alfred Hitchcock movie.
And then serves it even better. Like, I'm going to spoil the story, and I really don't care. But so,
spoiler alert.
So she goes to the store after she kills him, comes back, right, does her thing, calls the police and said, oh, my God, I went to the store and my husband's dead. And so the cops come and they're like, oh, I don't know what happened. She's like, oh, I just cooked some lamb. Would you like to eat it? And they're like, oh, the weapon could be right under our noses. She's like, oh, yes, it certainly could. So, I mean.
That's hilarious. I want to read
awesome that. How awesome is that? He's a very strange guy because he was kind of a spy. He had all kinds of weird
stuff.
Yeah, so him doing ghost stories does not surprise me in the slightest.
Well, do you think they're adult ghost stories or ghost stories? And Kate, if you know, drop us another email and let us know, uptodate@kcur.org. I'd be curious to know.
I would think adult.
That's adult.
You would think. Okay. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with our book doctors. We'll talk about some more scary stories. We'll also turn to Steve Paul's pick when he comes in here, The Letters of Ernest Hemingway. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about Woodrow Wilson, you can find that in all of our previous broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll take a look at the racial and political lines that divide this country and how our president fits in the middle of all of it. This hour, we're visiting with our book doctors. They are today Jeff Ann Gowdy, a freelance writer and editor, Steve Paul, who edits the Star's book page, Katie Stover from the Kansas City Public Library, and Mark Luce from the Barstow School. Good to have them all here. We're talking about some good Halloween reads in preparation for Halloween coming up here. 816-235-2888 for your recommendations. Our email address, up-to-date, at kcur.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Okay, let's move on here. And let's see, Jeff, the Yana Luce.
Yana Lassi Writing
Yana Lassi
Camp for
Writing
Girls,
Camp. I was
right.
going to get it sooner or later.
Yeah, I reviewed this for the Star in June, and it's by Anton D. Sclafani. Mm-hmm. And she teaches at Washington University in St. Louis, creative writing, which is where she got her MFA. And sort of the little question that looms over the novel is she got a seven-figure advance for this first novel. So, of course, the question is, does it deserve it? Well, what book does? I mean, you know.
Seven-figure advance.
Yeah.
That means like $1 million,
yeah,
right?
I mean, you kind of study it. You think, you know, like Steven Steigman said before the show, maybe they were putting the dot O-O as far as the seven figures. But no, supposedly, I read it in the Star, in fact.
Why would you get a $1 million advance for a first novel?
Okay. This is why I think Curtis Sittenfeld says on the cover, amazing, a sexy, suspenseful, gorgeously written book. And it is sexy, but in sort of a pulpy kind of way, sort of a real romantic kind of a way. Mm-hmm. It veers into romantic excess. You almost sometimes feel like you're reading a little bit of a romance in the description of the headmaster and mm-hmm. the illicit affair between the headmaster at this private school and the character. But anyway, I actually liked it. It was psychologically astute. It was atmospheric. It was steamy. It's the story of Thea Atwell, who is 15 years old, and she is exiled from her family to go to the Yana Lassi Writing Camp for Girls, which is in North Carolina. And we learn why she's been exiled from her family sort of in flashbacks. There's a dark mm-hmm. secret. And she has a transgression, and as you might guess, her transgression is sexual. But her brother's transgression is the bigger one, and it's violent, and he's not punished at all. But she's sent to this exclusive boarding camp, equestrian camp, and boarding school. And actually, her punishment is her reward, because she and her twin brother have seen virtually no other children as they were growing up. Their father homeschooled them. She rode her horse in the afternoon. Her brother rescued animals. And really, the only person that they saw their age was their older cousin. And he's the one she gets. Well, no, spoiler alert. Anyway, don't want to spoil that one. But in any case, her punishment is her reward, because she has a crash course in socialization and being around other kids, and her world opens up. So I think it's a psychologically astute study of a certain kind of insular family. And also the writing is compelling. It's a page turner.
So you think it was worth $1 million?
No, I didn't say that.
not going quite that far.
I mean,
right?
The inequities of the marketplace. You know, we could talk about.
Does she keep her job? So, if you get that advance, why are you keep working? Wouldn't you just? I'm going to write novels now.
I don't know.
Do you know what I mean?
I mean, it is.
Yes, I do know what you mean.
I would keep my job.
Yeah, absolutely.
Done. What we don't know, I haven't looked into it, but what we don't know is how it sold.
Right.
Right. We don't know, right. And it maybe it came with a movie option package deal. You know, maybe.
I bet right. so.
Yeah. And so that certainly right. plays into it. But still, we don't. You know, will she get another advantage? Will she get another contract?
How did it sell?
It got mixed reviews. It got some real positive reviews. I think who's the extremely severe critic for the New York Times? His name
Michiko.
Yes, she liked it.
Yeah,
but lots of other people did not, and made fun of it and sort of thought it was kind of the YA. What is this with girls and horses kind of thing? You know, but I think it's good.
You'd have to be how old to read this book?
Oh, you know, high school or above.
High school above. Yana Lassi?
I mean, it has some naughty Yana Lassi? Stuff, but, you know.
Writing Camp for Girls. Okay.
How naughty?
Yeah.
I mean, it's fine for teenagers.
PG-13?
Yeah.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Matthew from Kansas City, Missouri. Matthew, good morning. You're on with the book doctors.
Hi, book doctors. I had a recommendation for a Chuck Palahniuk book called Haunting. And I can't really describe. It's a compilation of 23 stories. They're all pretty too dark maybe to describe on radio. But wow. The epilogue was really interesting. There, he said that the first story in the compilation is called Guts. And he went around and did his book tour for, I think it was Diary, something like that. And he would do the reading of that story. And throughout the book tour, people kept fainting. So he said that once it was all said and done, he had knocked out 73 people with the story.
And it's haunted by Chuck. Say his last name.
Palahniuk.
It's the guy, the Fight Club guy.
The Fight Club guy. Palahniuk. Yeah.
Okay. Palahniuk. People fainting during book readings. That's a pretty serious recommendation there.
Read it sitting down, I would suggest.
All right.
Do you think if you heard that, would you pass out?
Well, I read through it and I got to admit, I felt a little lightheaded. But you get the luxury of pausing when you're reading it yourself. So.
What is the subject matter? Can you just give me three? It's Guts.
It's got to be.
Yeah. Okay.
Guts.
It's basically the first story. It's three different anecdotes, sort of about masturbation mishaps. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
Will.
Matthew, my goodness. All right.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I told you, can't describe much of it. Yeah.
Wow, that is intriguing.
Thanks very much, Matthew. I appreciate it. That's Haunted by Chuck Palahniuk or whatever.
Palahniuk.
Palahniuk. Okay, whatever. Steve writes us with a suggestion. How about the works of Ambrose Bierce, An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, Chickamauga, and The Affair at Coulter's Notch? Yeah, he also has a collection of horror stories. Yes.
That's a yes.
Yes. That's a four yeses.
Ambrose Bierce. B-I-E-R-C-E.
Bierce rhymes with fierce. Okay. You were asking about classics, Steve? Yeah. This one, Ambrose Bierce.
That sounds great.
Those classics that you go back to.
Yeah.
Over and over. Jill writes us this. One of the most haunting books I read as a kid was A Candle in Her Room by Ruth M. Arthur, about an ancient wooden doll named Ditto who had an evil influence on a girl. Does anyone remember it?
No, but that sounds creepy.
Yeah.
No, but that reminds me of John Saul's Comes the Blind Fury, which is really creepy.
You know, I was thinking about ghost stories, and there's a book, I think, published by KU Press called Haunted Kansas by Lisa Heights.
Yes.
Oh. That's more sort of in the folklore genre, going around and collecting, because some people genuinely feel their houses are haunted.
Mm-hmm. Some people's houses are haunted.
I think that's
the folklore houses. And legend thing. I'm sorry, I was racking my brain all morning, and I finally came up with what I was trying to remember. When I was a kid, you know, the one horror book that I read when I was a kid was called The Fool Killer by a woman named Helen Eustace. I have no idea whether it holds up or not. It apparently might have been based on an O. Henry story, but it also might have been based on a Southern Gothic kind of legend about a guy who roamed around the South with an axe, I think. And there was a kid in the story, and I seem to remember carnivals and towns, and it was kind of like The Road, but with an axe.
And no apocalypse.
And no apocalypse. But I remember it as being, at least at the time, as being quite a good read. I probably read it more than once.
Well, that rings a bell, Steve. Helen Eustace does. So yeah. Probably holds up.
Also, if you think about chilling folklore, the Brothers Grimm, the fairy tales. Mm.
Yeah,
Brothers
sure.
Grimm.
Mm.
The original
ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Angela writes us this with this horror suggestion, The Historian by Elizabeth Gustavo.
Don't know.
It was a big book. I didn't read it. Can't talk about it.
Vampire father-daughter drama going on, too.
You know, we certainly haven't talked about the classic vampire novel, of course, which comes from the 19th century, Bram Stoker's Dracula. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Twilight.
Oh, well, that,
you
too.
I love you, Mark.
You could put – you know, there is – I will say this. So I went to the bookstore the other day, went to Barnes & Noble out at because my son needed a book, and I knew that it was there. And I walked in there, and we're standing there, and I'm trying to find the right place. And the store's all different, and they sell way more toys now. Yeah. And so I'm standing there, and my son Miles, he's 11, and he's like, "Hey, Dad, look, there's your section." And so I look, and there's two giant shelves, and the title above is Teen Paranormal. And I'm just like, you've got, like, this is a marketing thing now. Teen Paranormal is worth two shelves, two giant shelves at Barnes & Noble. And all the covers look exactly the same. They all look like Twilight.
Yes. I'm afraid you're right. I was there looking for something that wasn't Teen Paranormal.
You can tell a book by the cover, as it turns out.
I know. Yes.
Ethan writes us at UpToDate@KCUR.org, suggests The Trial by Kafka.
that would qualify as it's a different kind of terrifying. Yeah. I mean,
or metamorphosis.
Metamorphosis. Sure, you wake up and you're a bug. That's not a good day.
Right.
Mary from Olathe writes, I remember reading Anne Rice's The Witching Hour as a freshman in college. I was living on my own for the first time, not on campus, and being so freaked out I couldn't sleep.
Yeah.
Makes sense, Jeff?
Yeah. Makes sense. I haven't read Anne Rice, I'm sorry to say.
Okay. I have not either. But yeah.
I've read one of her vampire novels, she certainly made a career out of it. That and porn, but soft porn. But
she's so popular.
Hawken from Kansas City, Missouri. Hawken, you're on with the Book Doctors. We're talking about good scary reads. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. I just had a subject back on the Sherlock Holmes. It's not really quite that scary, but it's just a really good mystery read. I agree with you on the fact that he's not like the most phenomenal writer ever. But if you read A Study in Scarlet, it is really good because you finish the book and you realize that you have about 200 pages left and you kind of go, what could happen? And I'm not going to spoil it for anyone, so you should just go out and read it because it's really, really interesting the way he turns it around.
Study in Scarlet, and Mark, you're thinking that sounds pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Good suggestion, Hawken. Thank you. Sharon from Kansas City, Missouri. Sharon, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to recommend Joyce Carol Oates' Zombie, which was a black and terrifying novel about Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh, boy.
The serial killer,
yes.
Young male. And, of course, she's got some wonderful gothic novels. The Belle Fleur, for instance, has a black side to it. Not really terribly scary, but very fun to read. And she did also write under a second name, wrote a number of mysteries that are pretty good, under the name of Rosalind Smith.
Right, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, Mark had mentioned whether Stephen King would probably be remembered in 100 years. I think we underestimate Joyce Carol Oates. I think there are times when people feel like, oh, there's another Joyce Carol Oates. She's so prolific. She puts out two or three novels a year or collections of short stories, but they're all pretty good. She's a great writer, and she does a lot of creepy stories. She does a lot of murder tales. And gothic things, and I think she's up there as well, and I think she will be remembered for a long time.
You know, that short story, Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been, is absolutely creepy.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the creepier stories that I think I've ever read.
And it's about what?
It's about a girl who's a bit vapid and just a teen, and a fellow named Arnold Friend shows up and wants her to take a ride with him.
Mm. Okay. Sharon, I'm glad you called. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good one.
Yeah, good conversation starter there. Yeah. Steve Paul, tell us about the letters of Ernest Hemingway, someone you know very, very well.
Oh,
you write a lot about
I'm sorry. I apologize. There's no Halloween in here that I know of. There's no real horror. it's kind of, there are times when it gets a little crazy. But this collection of letters is part of a long-running and major work of literary scholarship. Hemingway was a prolific letter writer. We know of at least 6,000 letters that exist, and that this project to publish all his letters will eventually publish over the years. They originally envisioned 12 volumes. Now it looks like it's going to be 16 volumes over the years.
And you're going to own all of them, aren't you?
I'm not sure I'm going to be around for all of them, but the second volume of letters has just now come out. The first one came out about 2 years ago and included a really nice batch of Hemingway's letters from Kansas City when he came
from Oak Park, Illinois, to Kansas City to work at the Kansas City Star. He wrote home. There were about 30 letters that he wrote from Kansas City to his parents and his sisters, mostly, and that was fun. Volume 2 it just focuses on 3 years, 1923 to 1925, which are among the most crucial years of Hemingway's life because he's in Paris for most of that time, and he's wrenching himself away from journalism. He was there's a little period there. He and his wife were in Toronto to have to birth their son, and he's still working for the Toronto Star and kind of hating it. And Gertrude Stein is telling him, "Don't get out of journalism. You want to be a writer." And so he finally does that. And this is the period when he's making his career in Paris, when he's writing short stories and starting to publish and making friends with people like Ezra Pound and Ford Madox Ford and editing a literary magazine.
So it's the stuff of Woody Allen's movie.
Yeah, a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could, yes, it is that. It is kind of that period.
He's working on In Our Time, right? I mean, those are the stories that are going to become In Our
Time.
He
is working, he's on the verge as this volume ends with the public, essentially with the publication of In Our Time, which I still maintain is his great book, first book of short stories. Hmm. But he's also finishing up. He started work on The Sun Also Rises, and he wrote the somewhat satiric and horrific book, but it's not much read anymore, called Torrents of Spring, which was a satire intended to kind of bite the hand of Sherwood Anderson and Gertrude Stein, both of whom were mentors of his, but he was slapping them around because he was trying to, show them up for various reasons. And these letters, you just see a side of Hemingway that you don't see often in his books. You don't see even in his biographies because you see a voice of somebody who's, boisterous and bold and kind of showing off and bragging and posturing and playing up to people like Pound with some kind of unfortunate ethnic slurs and that kind of thing because Pound kind of was that way and joking around with his friends back in Chicago and Michigan remembering those landscapes of his youth and that sort of thing. But he's writing these books. He's sending them out, getting them published. There's a story in here accompanying one of the letters that had never been published before. It was a story that he was offering to Vanity Fair. It was about a guy named Donald Ogden Stewart, and it's in the Bullring in Pamplona. And it had a little comic tone to it, and it was kind of fun to read. The editor of Vanity Fair sent it back to him and said, it's clever, but it's not quite what we're looking for. And it just sat and never got published. And so now you have the opportunity to read that story for the first time in this collection. Again, it's the Letters of Ernest Hemingway, Volume 2, the years 1923-25. I reviewed it in the Star on Sunday. And, it's the kind of thing that there's a team of editors involved, and they annotate the letters so they help you understand who the people are and what certain, what things mean and what some of the language means. Hemingway was playful with language. Some of the words I can't even speak, on the air. But he was having, he was just, like I said, showing off and playing with words, and you just see a side of him that's rather interesting. Is it for everybody? Do you like to read letters? If you like Hemingway, I think you'd enjoy reading this especially this period of his kind of career formation and his, finding him as this ambitious and really, large in life kid. He was only 25 years old
So this is volume 2 of 14 or 16 more
volume,
to go.
Yeah. So look forward. It came out just a few days ago. So.
The Letters of Ernest Hemingway. Okay, again, we're talking with our book doctors this morning. Our number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org. You can also tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Dennis suggests one book that scared him, The Monstromologist by Rick Yancey.
Oh, yes.
Oh, you know that one, Kate.
I do. That one's on my list of things to read, but Rick Yancey's Monstromologist is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Teens are loving that, and I know a lot of adults who like horror enjoying
teenagers.
That as well.
Okay.
Yeah, it was published, good. I think, as young adult, but that's got definite adult appeal.
Molly writes us at UpToDate@KCUR.org. I remember reading The Dollhouse Murders by Betty Wren Wright in fourth grade, and it was the first book I couldn't put down. The dolls systematically murder each other. What a concept. Okay.
Ooh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
Okay. Katie, where were we here? Tell us about Heart-Shaped Box by Joe Hill.
Oh, Heart-Shaped Box. This is one of my favorite horror novels. The internet is out to get you. And I haven't been scared by a horror novel since I was 14 until I picked this up. And mm-hmm. I was riding the 47 Roanoke at 8:30 in the morning, and I was too petrified to get off the bus.
Wow.
It was
wow.
daylight. But Joe Hill is the son of Stephen King, Daddy's little boy.
The aforementioned Stephen King.
All grown up, and he's inherited all of his father's spooktastic genes.
No kidding.
Yes.
His name is Joe Hill.
Joe Hill.
Not King, obviously. He's going
He's going by Hill. And this one revolves around the character of Jude Coyne. He's an aging rock god. Think James Hetfield from Metallica. And he's enjoying semi-retirement as a recluse on his farm with his beloved dogs. He's got mm-hmm. his latest groupie girlfriend. And he's got a really creepy hobby. He collects objets de macabre, just like nooses and funeral shrouds and things like that.
Wow.
And his latest addition to his ghoulish collection is a ghost. And the ghost arrives in this heart-shaped box. There's a Sunday suit. And when Jude opens up the box and takes out the suit, he releases the ghost. And this ghost has...
Not a good idea, by the way.
No. Yeah. And Jude bought it, knowing that it was a ghost on the... That's how they were selling it, a ghost on the internet. But this ghost emerges, and he's swinging this curved razor, and he's got these black eyes, and he's hypnotizing his victims. He hypnotizes Jude's assistant, Danny, and Danny hangs himself. Hypnotizes Georgia. She sticks a gun in her mouth. And even Jude's not immune to this. So he finds himself in the front seat of this, like, cream puff Mustang, and he's just inhaling carbon monoxide until Georgia saves him. So this tone,
wow.
The tone is gleefully morbid, and Joe Hill drops lots of snark, lots of that hipster humor that we're finding in more and more horror right now. But this plot, it plunges and flies like a roller coaster that's trying to dump all of the shrieking passengers.
Wow.
It's really original, and it is a nice honorable homage to his father.
I wonder if Dad read it before he put it out.
You know, if his father did, then his father probably would have told him to take out one segment at the very end of the book.
Ah, okay.
He has a new novel this year, with the unusual spelling of NOS4R2.
Yeah, like a license plate.
Yeah. And you know, there's another son, Owen King, I think,
Owen,
is
mm-hmm.
also writing, and then there's a daughter-in-law whose name escapes me, who's put out her first novel this year. So it's a clan of.
Wow.
What
kind of conversation would that be around a Thanksgiving table every year?
When Heart-Shaped Box first came out.
Yeah, exactly.
Joe Hill immediately identified as Stephen King's son? Because I remember it was sort of a surprise to people.
It was a surprise to a lot of readers. Anybody who opened up the back page could see. I mean, he just looks just like his dad, a young version of his dad. Is it in the bio? No. It was one of those things that the publishing world knew, but no one was flogging this book as Joe Hill, son of Stephen King. It was one of those just not talked about facts, but it wasn't a surprise for most people who knew this.
Interesting choice, the marketing choice to make there. Mark from Overland Park. Mark, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, since the topic of the day is frightening stories, I thought of one that I had read a long time ago. It's the Necroscope series by Brian Lumley.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if any of you are familiar with that.
Yes, I'm familiar with Brian Lumley. He's still
popular.
Well,
good. Yeah, hopefully you can expound on it a little bit, since I don't remember much of the plot other than it frightened me terribly. It's quite suspenseful and quite a good story about the evil natures of the vampire.
Okay. Mark, thank you.
Yeah, this one is so far removed from my memory. It's been years and years.
Jeff Ann Gowdy, tell us about The Pure Gold Baby by Margaret Drabble.
Okay, this is not a horror book at all, but Margaret Drabble has been one of my favorite authors for years.
Well, and Pure Gold Baby might be a horrifying story. That's kind of a weird idea.
There you go. Yeah. This is her 18th. What's that? This is her 18th novel, and I think I've read 12 of her books, starting from way back in 1963. She's a wonderful writer. She's also been the editor of the Oxford Companion to English Literature a couple of times. And for her output, she has been named a Dame of the British Empire in 2008. So Dame Drabble's book is about the Pure Gold Baby. The Pure Gold Baby is Anna, who is what we would now call a special needs child. Mm-hmm. And this is the story of her and her mother, Jess. Jess is a trained anthropologist who, because of her child's need, abandons the field and just writes for the academic and popular press. And this is narrated by Eleanor, who's an attorney and a friend in their North London neighborhood. And she frequently breaks out of the narrative frame to address the reader. So she tells you not to feel sorry for Jess because she's not an object of pity. And the story encompasses 40 years in the story of Jess and Anna and also their social circle. It goes backwards and forwards. But for Jess, the sort of defining moment in her career was when she went as a young woman to Africa, to what is now Zambia, and saw children with forked and fused toes. And what struck her about the children is they're completely unaware of their difference from the norm. They just happily paddled their boats around. And it predicted in some way the birth of her own child, who has a sunny disposition and is completely unaware of her difference from the norm. But as a freelance journalist, I love the amount of just random information that's in this book. You know, there's stuff about infrastructure of London. There's the history of the mental health care industry in Britain. There's a lot of stuff about brutalism, an unfortunate trend in architecture in Britain, and a lot of byways. And I think she's a great writer. But in addition to it being chock full of information, it is a really warm and witty and wise story. Couldn't recommend it highly enough.
The Pure Gold Baby by Margaret Drabble.
Just published October 1.
Mark, I'll give you 10 seconds on The Grifters by Jim Thompson and The Killer Inside Me.
The Killer Inside Me is probably the creepiest book that anyone will ever read. It's Joe, the guy's name's Lou Ford. He's a, by day he's a cop, by night he's a crazed killer.
Wow.
It's as creepy as it gets.
The Killer Inside Me by Jim Thompson.
Yeah.
Okay, that'll have to wrap it up here. We ran through our choices of great scary stories with our book doctors today, Jeff Ann Gowdy, Katie Stover, Steve Paul, and Mark Luce. Thanks all for coming in.
Yeah, thanks
for coming. Always
fun
to have you guys here. You can find more information about all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, we'll take a look at the racial and political lines that divide this country and how the president fits in the middle of all of them. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.